Hello and welcome to another episode of Mere Fidelity, where we have conversations about life, theology, the church, and the culture. My name is Derek Rishmawi. I'm joined by Alistair Roberts today, as well as a special guest, the illustrious, the honorable, the right, I don't know, can't work the right in there, the one and only Dr. Alan Noble, who is an assistant professor of English at Oklahoma Baptist University, co-founder and editor-in-chief of Christ in Pop Culture, writes all over the place, tweets definitely all over the place, and is the author of a new book called Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. So we're very excited to have Alan on the show today. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Say a thing. Thank you for having me. at 7:30 a.m. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Here being the phone.
The internet.
And not yeah, I mean, we're all in physical time and space, but
yep.
Except for maybe Alistair, who, well, we have questions about. So with that kind of silliness out of the way, we do want to get to the book. So Disruptive Witness, Speaking Truth in a Distracted Age. What's the essential question that kind of provoked you to write the book? Like what's the heart of the book? What was the question you wanted to answer, or that drove you, that kind of drives the thesis of this thing?
So I was heavily influenced by Francis Schaeffer growing up. I was very homeschooled, as I like to say in my bio, and I took a class with other homeschoolers on Francis Schaeffer, How Then Should We Live? And a few years ago, I was thinking about Schaeffer and his work, specifically the different libraries that he founded, and this model where, at least the way it was, you know, communicated to me, you know, all these people from around the world in the 60s and 70s particularly were coming to him with these big life questions. They might have been Buddhists or Hindu or, you know, lapsed Christians or hippies, but they had this ache, this desire to answer a question. You know, why are we here? What is life about? How do we make sense of the world? And then Schaeffer would, in these different libraries, these communities, they would spend time together and they would discuss these life questions. And I was reflecting on that and I asked myself, well, do I think that model would work in 2018, or has something changed in at least American culture so that model where people are attracted to and desire to have life's big questions answered would be no longer feasible? And I found myself answering it, you know, sort of my gut reaction was that I don't think that would really work. I don't think it would have the same pull as it did in the 60s and 70s. And so then I asked, well, why not? And that question sort of led me to sort of two forces that I felt had shaped culture in such a way that the work of bearing witness, the work of evangelism, needed to take at least a slightly different form. So the conclusion was that I don't think many people are asking the same sort of life questions, at least not in the same number as they did in the 60s and 70s. And there are some historical reasons for that. But the other reasons I argue in the book are technology of distraction, which makes it easier for us to push those questions aside so that we really just don't have to deal with them. And then a barrier of secularism, which, of course, was a reality in the 60s and 70s as well, but I do think has progressed in some ways. And so the book sort of works out those questions and then tries to offer some manner of way out or a way of mitigating technology of distraction in secularism.
Okay, that's helpful.
I find it interesting you raise the issue of the Labrie model. I'm actually going to be speaking at the Labrie in the UK in just a week's time on the subject of technology and the way that it forms the self. And it's definitely an issue they've been thinking a lot about, and it's very much a live issue within that context, because so many people that now come there are addicted to technology, and the role of the mobile phone keeping people constantly connected to the outside world and plugged into this dense social but abstract social network and realm, it makes it very difficult for the form of formation that they practice within that community to operate effectively. And so they do have strong policies that they've had to introduce on the use of connected devices for that reason.
Well, that's interesting. Do you know what those policies are?
Generally, you're just not supposed to use connected devices while you're there.
That's a good policy. Just blank, just a blanket
straight
policy.
Up, no,
just yeah, that's right. The policy is stop. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot.
But they also have a lot of talks. They also have a lot of talks on the subject and discussion of this subject because it is such a pertinent one for the formation of the self within the current context.
Yeah, I've often, out of writing this book, thought about universities. I mean, I teach at a university, but obviously I don't get to control our policies except in my own classroom. And it would be nice if universities would adopt similar policies to create that kind of environment where formation can happen and students can walk around thinking about the things that they were discussing in class. But that's not a very sexy policy if you want to attract students and keep them, telling them, you know, you can't walk around looking at your phone.
So with that, so the technology and the secularism, you talked about the way that they, in a sense, dovetail in distraction, right? That secularism kind of buffers out the big questions or impinging transcendent realities. And then, technology, if you have any kind of lingering thoughts about it, technology is kind of like, oh, look, a squirrel. And you don't have to, you know, you just, the Doug effect. I don't really need to think about that because Angry Birds or whatever game is now what people do, because that's the last phone game I ever played. Kind of want you to expand on that more. I'm at this point in life, I'm kind of curious to see which is more the chicken or the egg now, right? I remember the transition of life pre-phone. I remember having the Nokia that had only the snake game on it, which I was never very good at. But I remember that and then going to a screen and then going to full-fledged internet apps, all that sort of things. And then there are all the students now who don't and who've never had that. And I'm the crowding, in a sense, the mental crowding has always been there.
Right.
In which case, that is where I'm curious about that. If you've read up on that or expanded more, at which point are we in that regard with younger folks? So if you want to go down that road.
So are you asking which started?
I'm kind of asking, like, now for most people, they've never encountered these questions, or they used to, and now they just use their phone to distract themselves more.
Well, I mean, everybody has these questions anyway, right? So everybody at some point is faced with a question, or at least the gut feeling of, you know, what is my worth in the world? Why do I get out of bed in the morning? So the questions are always there. I suppose the issue is whether we're entertaining these questions and whether we're pushing into those questions and seeking out answers. One of the things that technology does for, I think, a great many people, particularly those addicted to it, is that your phone is a way of dealing with anxiety. And often life's big questions creates a sense of existential dread or a weightiness. And one way of dealing with that is just not dealing with it at all. And there's a way that, you know, picking up your phone is kind of like a pacifier or something. You can, you feel the anxiety of life alleviated a little bit. Even if, and this is the, you know, this sort of sickness of it, even if when you pick up your phone and you turn onto social media and you're overwhelmed with a different kind of anxiety, but it's a kind of distant anxiety. So if I'm stressed about American politics, you know, going to hell, that's in some sense easier for me to mentally cope with than, I guess the possibility of myself going to hell.
It's kind of like that old Three Stooges joke where you, my head hurts, and he steps on his foot. Oh,
that's right.
Now I'm on my foot. Oh, well, see, your headache's gone. We do that, but existentially with our phones.
Yeah. So David Foster Wallace has an interesting definition, or at least understanding of the way addiction works. And he, in this article, he writes about television and the way it was creating, you know, actually some of these similar effects on people. He argues that addiction is this dynamic where it, something creates the problems it's trying to cure. And so there's this, you keep going back for it and it actually keeps making you worse, but you keep going back to get alleviation. And I do think for many people, technology has that or can have that effect. It doesn't have to, but I think it often does.
Yeah. Alistair, you get a question here?
You talk a lot about the way that the human being is shaped by these sorts of things. I'd be interested to hear where these concerns really arose from in your own life. Was it the experience of primarily the experience of teaching students or being a father or just your own experience? And how did those things fit together?
Definitely the students and definitely my own experience. I feel these things acutely. So some people write books or start projects or, you know, videos or something or programs or institutes because they've recognized some problem and then they've become the model of how to beat it. So, you know, I've lost 50 pounds. I'll show you how I did it. And that's sort of the guru model, which is very attractive in the modern world. We love our gurus. But that's definitely not how I wrote this book. I mean, a lot of this just comes out of, you know, frankly, my own wrestling, and I tried to keep that in the language. I tried to just be honest about, you know, these are the things that, you know, many days I struggle going upstairs, not to look at my phone. You know, that sense of addiction, because I don't want to set myself up as a guru. But it did inspire, you know, sort of, feeling those, having those experiences and sort of searching out, you know, okay, why is it that I feel this need? It's not just the sort of physiological addiction. It's filling some emotional need. And what is that? And why? And what am I losing? And so that definitely helped me explore. And then also seeing my students, seeing how they're affected by it. Seeing, you know, it's, for example, it's a very common story for my students to tell me when there's a period of stress, when there a period where they feel overwhelmed, their defense mechanism for many of them is to binge watch. So they'll say, Dr. Noble, I know I have a test coming up tomorrow, but I watched 10 episodes of Friends last night instead. And they'll be like, why would you do that? And, you know, because, it, you know, it's an easier way of coping with things. And if that's how they're dealing with stress, you know, I think it's also how they're dealing with, other life issues. So, yeah, so definitely out of my own experience, out of the experience of my students, my kids are pretty young still, and we sort of monitor their screen time very closely. So, haven't had as much inspiration from them yet. Hopefully keep it that way.
You talk about the example of addiction and talk about the individual experience of that. But in many ways, this is a collective social addiction, where in the past you'd have an addiction and you could have resources within your community that would be able to bring you back to health. For us, our community is accessed in many ways through the addiction, through our urge to be connected to each other. And so where do we find resources to push back against this collective addiction, and how can we help others? And this is really, I suppose, moving very much into the discussion of the first word of the title of your book. How can we disrupt this?
Yeah. I think, so you have an example of this when you were talking about, LaBrie. So here you have a small institution, a community. It's a shifting community as people move in and out over time, but it is a community where people can get some kind of education, some lectures about, okay, here's what technology is doing to you. And, here are some policies that are going to help, incentivize you or force you to deal with the ramifications of these addictions so that you can live in healthier ways. I mean, that seems like the most obvious sort of first level of response is institutions like churches. Ideally colleges. And so, especially my freshman classes, but actually, you know, just all throughout, whenever I can, whenever it's pertinent, I take the time to talk to them about, how technology is affecting them, their identity, their study habits, their memory, their ability to retain or to contemplate and wrestle with ideas. And so that's kind of our first line of defense. The challenge is that, when we think about communities, if we're talking about sort of geographic communities, then what I've just described are just sort of, fortresses, small areas of resistance. The vast majority of our, geographic or civic communities are still going to be addicted to these things. I think on a larger scale, one thing that can be done is putting pressure on tech companies to try to think ethically about what they're doing. So Apple has made a very minor step that will probably make very little to no difference. But, in their latest iOS, they have ways of tracking your apps and how much time you're spending and then setting time limits on them. Now, before, you could download apps to do this for you, but now they're recognizing that they need to build it into the operating system because they've built something that is out of control. I think that's going to have very limited success, but, in human history, so what happens is we innovate, we create a new technology, and then over time, society recognizes or can identify the harms that maybe they didn't anticipate with that technology. And then we create laws and create social norms to curb those harms while still benefiting from the technology. And the challenge for our era is that innovation happens so rapidly that we can't keep up. Our laws and our social norms cannot remotely keep up with innovation. So I don't know what the answer to that is. It feels like we need to think about curbing. There's something about that delay between innovation and laws and norms that we've got to do something about as a society. And I don't know what that is, but we need to rethink it because it's different. I think it's different than any other time in history. And so it's going to require a different approach.
Let me ask a society-wide question for dealing with this. But I love that you have a chapter on, in a sense, disruptive church practices. And without even going into that, churches, I've worked in them. I've attended them my whole life. I can see where many staffs are going. The drive, especially in evangelical churches, to adopt new technological advancements as quick as they come out, or maybe as quick as they've now phased out everywhere else and but are cool for churches to use, the tried and true evangelical way. Thinking that through differently in light of what you've been writing and articulating, in a sense, what would you, if you could have every pastor in a room, like what's like that yeah. one line that you would look at them and say to them about technological, incorporating technological advancement within the worship service, within the way that they're, within the way their church runs, so on and so forth? What would you say to them? In yeah. light of what you've been reading?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I've had a few opportunities like this. And I, to me, sort of the first order priority I have is twofold. One, I think churches need to set rules, just like Alistair described at LaBrie, where even though it's super convenient to just bring your phone to church and read the Bible on your phone so you can pick your own translation and look up the Greek while you're, you know, the pastor's preaching, I think the norm should be your phone needs to be put away and people should not be saying it. That's not the norm. Unfortunately, I mean, the only time I've seen that actually is at a local black church here in Shawnee that I visited a few times. And I was surprised and encouraged by that. Was like one of the first things they said at the opening of the service was like, your phones need to be put away, they need to be turned off or, you know, muted. And I thought that, you know, it's demanding a sense of presence that is uncomfortable for us. So I think that's, you know, there are a lot of low-hanging fruit that churches can do, and that's one of them. And to go along with that, I do think pastors need to, at times, whether it's through Sunday school or just, you know, weaving into their sermons, I think they do need to talk about the habits. The digital habits of their congregation. And I'm leery to do this because it sounds like almost like too much life advice. And I know growing up in the church, whenever pastors sort of get into like practical life advice, here's how you should live, sometimes it creeps into a kind of legalism. And I don't want that. But I do think that some of these things have become so pervasive, you know, the way we shape our identities based on social media, the way that we can't put our technology down, the way that we can't see the glory of creation because we are so distracted by things. I think it actually has gotten to the point where it's actually worth pastors addressing, you know, sort of from the pulpit, not as a whole sermon, but as an aside.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it's that bad. That to me, I agree. We've gotten, I think, especially younger pastors who kind of, I don't know, you listen to a bunch of the preachers that were hot by 5 to 10 years ago, and they'd like to rail, at least in reform circles, like to rail on life advice sermons. And there's this part of me that has gone back, and I look back at Proverbs or other works we have in Scripture, and I think, you know what, actually, preaching is supposed to get into some practicalities like that from time to time or week to week. And so I really do think the application and the move towards actually addressing specific technological temptations is a very wise one, a very timely one. In fact, maybe a little bit late to the game if we haven't been already. Alistair, follow-up thoughts or questions?
A lot of the discussion that you have within the book about concepts like the Nova effect, the buffered self, things like that, are drawn from the work of Charles Taylor. Mm. How did you find his work really speaking into this sort of issue in a way that you... And it seems clear to me that you felt inspired to bring his insights to a popular audience so that more people could benefit from them. And what particularly did you gain from reading his work?
So some of the best, or if not, maybe it is the best thinkers, in my mind, are the ones where when you read their works, they're telling you things that in some sense you've understood in just very minor ways or very superficial ways, and you've hungered for an explanation or a detail and labels and a system to understand it. And that was Taylor for me. I had to read him for my dissertation, and I worked with him in my dissertation. And when I read him, it felt like there was some illumination to the way that I was perceiving our culture. So, for example, I've for many years prior to that, I had been struck by the proliferation of basically subcultures and the way that technology has allowed specifically communities, very, very, very niche communities. I remember being in a Panda Express while I was going to, I think, community college back in Southern California, and talking to a friend about how it's possible today to be into some very niche thing. So like you could be into like 1950s John Wayne cowboy culture, and you could find an online community that's into that, and like you could buy products to fill your house with that aesthetic, and you could essentially sort of live in this very niche weird world. And that's
hey there, partner.
Very
hold
weird.
On, that's not that weird, right?
That's right,
partner.
Yeah.
Okay,
sorry. But there's like a million there, or if not a billion, of those little niche things, and it struck me that people living in those communities, those largely digital communities, but sometimes local aspects to them, could have lives where they have, you know, what Taylor would later, you know, help me, you know, give me the language to talk about fullness. So they would see, okay, this is what how I orient my life toward fullness. This is what seems to give it meaning. And it, you know, it helped, Taylor helped explain to me why people living in all these different, you know, niche communities could feel content, could feel, could live with the cognitive dissonance that their neighbors live extremely different lives and have extremely different sets, you know, visions of fullness for their own lives. And I do think, and so that's, you know, I talk about micro narratives of justification, that's what I think I was observing, and then I read Taylor, and he talks about the Nova effect, where you know, the vision of fullness just explodes. So there's not just like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam as in the Middle Ages. There's about, you know, as many visions of fullness as there are people, and they're rapidly expanding, and there's a sense of flatness to them all. Yes, absolutely. So he was incredibly helpful for me, providing the language and framework and history to understand those things.
It's extremely useful. Turning back a corner again, the one that has always, the issue of kind of witness that has been a trouble spot in a lot of ways for evangelical churches is cultural witness, in a sense. The you know, we can think of personal evangelism, we can think of building Christian institutions as churches, although that's kind of a weak spot as well. But we've done it in the past. But cultural participation in a way that isn't just the creation of safe Christian subcultures for Christians to hide out in, or cheap knockoffs to try and kind of sneak into the broader world. Talk to me more about what do you think are some of the most important ways that Christians are to, in a sense, disrupt and witness, disruptive witness to the culture broader cultural participation, that chapter.
Yeah. So I think I'm biased here because I do study literature. So I do think sort of my habit is to think in terms of the arts. But I'll tell you, here's an example of how this could work. My wife and I came very late to the film Tree of Life. We watched it just this year. But when we watched Malick slowly moving through the beauty of creation and the universe and the beauty of very simple, subtle, otherwise trivial seeming moments in our lives, like we're brought to tears. My reaction was quite literally, I wanted to repent for taking for granted the goodness of being, of creation, of God, you know, allowing me to exist. That film, for those who can sit through it, and we need to talk about that, but for those who can sit through it, I think it really is a disruptive witness, because what it does is it cuts through all the sense that we – all these this feeling that we live in a purely naturalist world. It forces you to sit for long periods of time and just contemplate beauty and not just like, you know, color, but also the beauty of human life in its goodness and its depravity, you know, the goodness of creation. And it really does puncture that imminent frame in a sense. Charles Taylor, near the end of A Secular Age, talks about needing a new kind of language that will speak to people who their base assumption is we live in an immanent frame, a totally naturalist world. And it kind of cuts through that and speaks to them. It acknowledges them where they are, but it also says this isn't all there is. And I think his example is Flannery O'Connor, and that's one example. But I think Terrence Malick does that. The challenge is, you know, when I think, okay, this is a great film, and so if I applied the principles of my book, what I would do is I would have like a movie night, and I would invite all my neighbors over, and I would make them sit for like 2+ hours and watch a Terrence Malick film. And most of my Oklahoma neighbors would get up and leave, you know, after 10 minutes and probably never speak to me again, because they'd be like, what is this film? And that's part of the challenge. It's not an easy one. I think Cormac McCarthy's The Road does a good job of balancing the ability to capture people's imagination and hold that imagination while still really viscerally forcing them to ask questions like, what makes it worth living? If you don't have hope that tomorrow humanity will continue to exist, why stay alive? That's not a question that modern people want to ask. Cormac McCarthy makes you ask that if you read it. So to me, those are the kinds of works Christians can and should be producing that force people to sit with hard, ugly things, like in Cormac McCarthy's The Road, or beautiful things like in Terrence Malick's Tree of Life.
On that, I know we're sticking in the film range, which is maybe more indicative of kind of the cultural niche that we inhabit. I hate horror films. I'll put it on the record that this is not the thing that I do. I spend my time doing. My wife, though, watches them a lot.
Your wife watches horror films?
My wife loves horror films. I blame – there's a friend of mine who got us – and I've seen a few. The thing that she's commented, and I've picked up as I've seen a couple of them with her, is the phenomenon of horror films to press on questions of evil, questions just the malevolence of some evil in the world, how it's rooted in, I don't know, things like family trauma, cultural history, and the weirdness. You know, talk about the imminent frame, disenchantment and all that kind of stuff. The pervasive presence of ghost stories and the rise of the horror film, that can be its own kind of secularizing force if we take it as a sense of kind of making these things palatable and entertaining. At the same time, they poke on something. They poke on something that people, I think, have this ineradicable sense that there are more things, things that go bump in the night that are not encompassed in materialistic philosophies. And they're, in that sense, more, in a way that is maybe less highfalutin, more accessible, more immediate, and even in some ways visceral than like a 2.5-hour Malick film. The horror phenomena is a thing that is worth exploring. And I don't know that, I mean, I know that some Christians have produced some, folks that are Christians have done. And that one to me is an interesting, way of puncturing the imminent frame that isn't so much old school secularism and, you know, Christianity as a worldview, but more like, hey, there's some, it is, but it's going straight for the weirdness jugular, the weird supernatural jugular, in a way that seems to be culturally pervasive as a sensibility now. Alistair, you've been silent for a while. I'm curious what you have to say.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for films like that. I find it interesting. May just be me paying more attention, but I think there's been a bit more public comment around certain horror films of late, things like Get Out and A Quiet Place and those sorts of things that really touch on deep cultural issues and questions. I'm sure Alan will be pleased to hear that Terrence Malick has just released an extended version. It's kind of, I think it's 40, 50 minutes longer than the original version of Tree of Life. It's now available on all DVDs and Blu-rays of that film.
I don't know.
Anyway, I was going to ask about one of the things that I find when I'm reading books, when I'm reading things online, when I'm hearing sermons, whatever it is, something about the current age that we're in and the way it's focused upon spectacle and connecting through information and consuming information merely to feel connected and to feel at the forefront of the current debate and the conversation and able to say intelligent things into it, all these sorts of things, that there's not a process of metabolizing that and bringing it out in action. And your book is a book that really calls for some sort of change of life. What are some of the specific ways in which you think people can move from reading your book to very practical forms of action? And how would you encourage them to overcome that urge just to read it, think that's a great book, and put it down and go on doing the same things?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I had my students read Alan Jacobs' article for The Guardian that came out, I think, earlier this year about temporal space or something, where he argues and precisely what you're talking about, where there's this, we have this sense that either we're missing out and so we have to keep on top of things, or we have this moral obligation to be up to date on all things. And there's this presentism that is attached to it. Like, we've got to be focused on the present. And Jacobs points out that, you know, studying the past, reading old books, for example, recognizing that although this moment is a unique moment, in some sense, it's also, in many other senses, not unique, that there is this great human tradition that you can study that helps bring to light and put in context what's going on today. I guess that would be, you know, sort of riffing off of Jacobs. I've been convicted of that. I'm thankful that I teach at a university where we have a Western civilization course where we teach over two semesters. We meet every single day and we start with the Greeks and we go through the 1990s. so that students are forced to see, you know, that history didn't start with, you know, I don't know, 9/11, that there's so much more, and that the so much more, you know, reading Dante actually enlightens us to what's going on today. I'm actually about to teach Dante starting tomorrow. Just thinking about the way he thinks of sloth as this spiritual problem where we don't seek to improve our souls, we're not seeking after God. That has struck me as a particularly, I mean, he felt it in the, you know, 13th century, and it feels like so much more of a pressing issue today, this sense where we just don't actively seek after God and improving our souls. So the, you know, practical things that we can do, I mean, one of those I think would be when we are consuming, you know, when we are reading, diversifying our reading. And I guess this is C.S. Lewis as well. You know, he makes this point, but, you know, making sure that we're not just reading the news, that we're not just reading the latest things. We're not just watching, for example, new movies. We're watching old movies, old things that help us put things into context. And then also practically, I don't know if people need to set schedules for this or just make personal habits where they are very intentional about not being entertained in any sense. So, for example, I walk to work. Spending that time walking to work and not listening to music, not listening to a podcast, not listening to an audiobook, except this podcast, is, you know, that's an opportunity for me to digest the content that I am reading. And we have lots of moments like that that we tend to just absolutely fill. So, I mean, so many of us, I mean, we can't even go to the bathroom without being plugged in. And so I think, to sort of summarize my answer, I think, you know, part of it would be getting out of the present. And the second would be making sure that, and this is sort of the lowest bar, but making sure that we have moments where we're not being crowded with new content, where we're actually forced to just meditate, to just think about stuff that we've engaged with. And for most people, I think those two things would be a huge help. And there are other things that we can do that are more intentional, but I think those are two practical, basic, valuable life choices.
And with that, I think we will bring this conversation to a close and allow our listeners to process and meditate and digest what we've been working through. So after this podcast, stop. Don't do anything else. Listen to anything else. Just meditate deeply on Alan's wise words. But really, though,
read the book and then meditate. Yeah, on that.
There we go. Excellent. He's okay. Got the book plug in. Alan, thanks for joining us on the show today. It's a real, real pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, it was an honor. I love what you guys do and I appreciate it. So I was thrilled to be asked on.
All right. So once again, the book, Disruptive Witness, Alan Noble. Pick it up, read, meditate, and then live. With that, we will wrap it up for today. This is Mere Fidelity.